So you know what? Shit comes in cycles. I say that as I am currently in an airship flying above the Dreamlands, and that was where I was almost a year ago, with all that Shredder nonsense. Yep, last year, this time, same place, different shit, different ship. Airships, I think someone, probably Tabitha, refers to them as dirigibles. Yeah, that's the benefit of a private education. Smart kid with a big vocabulary. Seems to be to the Dreamlands what Priuses are to Hollywood. The flavor du jour when it comes to executive transportation. Anyway, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself yet again. Let's talk about the Silent City. So, there we were. We few. I'd like to think happy few. Having the eternal debate. Should we wait for backup or kick in the metaphorical door of the Silent City? The original plan was for the Bloodsuckers and us to arrive simultaneously and then head into the Silent City together, presumably with the Bloodsuckers going first. But that plan was pretty much foobar as we arrived a full 24 hours ahead of schedule, and we were already inside the Ring of Death. While we were vigorously debating, we happy few suddenly grew as out of the blue, Madame Isabeau appeared with Tabitha and Devereaux in tow. I just realized a lot of rhyming in that previous sentence. For the record, that's a coincidence. I'm not, I repeat, not losing my marbles. Isabeau dropped them off, told them to cooperate. And then she was gone again, without so much as a, hey, how are you? So the Silent City is a pit. Literally. For part of it, because on this side it seems to have collapsed and fallen into a pit. A path leads through the bottom to the center, where we could see four ziggurats, if that's the correct word, which were our target. We presume that's the case. We don't know, because even though we have A. Devereaux with us, and she's supposed to know where she's going, for all she brings to the group, we might just as well have had Penn and Teller with us. Just as much magical bang for the buck, but at least Penn is funny. You know, I'm still in stitches about the aristocrats. So, no going through the pit. Stick to the high ground. So we started walking. And then we ended up at the same spot after an hour or two. This was clearly not right. What was even less right was that Tabitha and Devereaux were no longer with us. The two of them taking sudden leave was, right, nothing new, but usually Isabeau was involved, and right now she was not. There was some blabbering from Frost, who is genuinely starting to worry me, about arcano-spatial-temporal distortion, and how I should be more like Tom Cruise. See what I mean about the blabber? I was afraid he'd taken a bite from the same cheese as Elizabeth, you should all come together first, and I really wasn't in the mood for that shit. I think I replied that as long as I got to bang Mimi Rogers, Nicole Kidman, and Katie Holmes, I'd be happy to be Tom Cruise. But until Frost made that happen, he ought to shut the fuck up and just stick with the program. Yeah, I'm really worried. You know, he's been a bit loopy since the bookstore episode. I like less and less all this whining about Firth playing with his magic box. Gee, I hope that's not a euphemism. Anyway, I've often found it best to persevere and try to ignore the weird shit around you. So we set off walking again. And we arrived at our point of departure again. This time, minus Frost and Wilmot. Talk about mixed blessings. While Chief and I were pondering, and Chief is nothing if not ponderous, what we were going to do next, Frost appeared from behind us. He said that the Silent City was basically fucking with the weak-minded, and that we needed to get attuned to it, so it would let us go where we wanted. He also drew our attention to a cloud that was coming in. Not exactly hard and fast, but definitely against the prevailing winds. Devereaux said it was an Iron Army airship, which is kind of a downer. I sat down and tried to reach out and get in harmony with the environment. I succeeded, eventually, but the experience left me with a serious headache and a cold, empty feeling. I may have become attuned to this damn place, but I guess it attuned to me at the same time. Which kind of proves that Nietzsche was onto something about this whole staring into the abyss deal. We joined the others, and I asked Devereaux about the airship. She announced that she, Isabeau, and Tabitha have been raiding Iron Army armories in order to hinder their sorcerer's efforts. Okay, points for that, ladies, but while you were at it, could you not have covered your tracks just a bit better and brought some of those machine guns the Iron Goons seem to be capable of wielding around these parts? So we decided to head on to the city. Wilmot on point, Frost and Chief flanking Summers, Devereaux and Tabitha in the center, and me bringing up the rear. The place was in ruins, but otherwise it was as advertised. That is, full of giant, cow-sized, motherfucking spiders jumping at us from holes in the ground. Trapdoor spiders, as it were. First there was one who almost dragged me down, until I ran my sword through its mandibles and scrambled up the side of the pit so fast I thought I'd become fucking Spider-Man. You know, on reflection, Frost's an idiot. He should have maybe become Tobey Maguire, not Tom Cruise, which would have worked out for me. I'll take Kirsten Dunst over Katie Holmes any day of the week. So, one spider down, and then its five cousins attacked, lobbing sticky goo at us, which held us in place. The fight was messy, but we carried the day, mostly because of Devereaux, who turned out to be capable of setting our swords on fire, which worked well enough against the spider goo and worked very well against the spiders. We had only one casualty, Frost. He'd taken a spider bite on the arm. Unlike Peter Parker, he gained no spider senses, but rather seemed to have taken leave of his senses. He behaved like he just kicked back the proceeds of a drug raid. A mix of high-end marijuana and top-notch MDMA, I would think. Summers volunteered to keep him in line, which she did admirably well. Her prescriptions involved ear-twisting and an occasional knock over the head with her staff. That's a crying shame that back in the real world she's in a coma. We moved on, started exploring the ziggurats in the center of the city, all the while keeping an eye on our approaching airship. I think it was in the second one, one where the steps collapsed and Wilmot slid back down, where Summers got us all a break. Ziggurat 2 was a small maze with dead-end corridors guarded by statues representing twisted versions of ancient Egyptian gods. According to Frost, these were the ghoul aspects of the Egyptian pantheon. How he knows that, I don't know, but it would explain their alternative appearances. One of the statues turned out to be an effigy of Zokalar, Summers' new patron. I have no idea what exactly happened, but Zokalar, a great body but not much of a conversationist from what I remember, interceded on our behalf, or her behalf, I guess, and opened a portal for us to step through. The portal would lead to us to a place of testing, and if we passed the tests, we would be able to go anywhere in the Dreamlands. Frost had to be whacked over the head a couple of times as he was getting a bit frisky with the women in the group, and Devereaux took a lot of persuading, but finally, we went through. After stepping through the gate, I felt rejuvenated, and Frost sobered right up. Damned if I did not prefer him whacked out of his skull, because he started griping about our general lack of preparation and the fact that we had no idea what we were doing. Which part of this didn't he not understand, that it was improvisation from the very beginning? But too late now. The portal led us to a hallway, which in turn led to a massive amphitheater, my best guess, oval in shape, and about 250 yards along its longest axis, with two massive spear-wielding ghoul Anubises, or is it Anubi, flanking a throne on a raised dais. I sent Wilmot ahead to scout, down the stairs leading to the floor, and the minute he set foot on it, the Anubises started to stir. Then, out of the shadows stepped a guy. All right. He was dressed like an ancient Egyptian priest, and he was speaking Chinese. Mandarin, to be precise, which, can you believe it? Frost happens to speak. So using Frost as our interpreter, we learned that we had to pass five tests, either in the god speech or in the universal language. After a short debate, we chose the universal language, because it sounded, well, more universal. A circle of light appeared, and at the far end of the amphitheater, the dais was now occupied by a black man, truly jet black, wearing a kilt and kitted out with pharaonic accoutrements, double crowns, headdress, but notably no vulture and cobra diadem. I felt goosebumps. This did seem familiar. Shit comes in cycles, remember? I had seen this before, a year ago, below the City of the Dead in Cairo. The Black Pharaoh. Frost also caught on quick and blurted the name Nyarlathotep. If the Black Pharaoh overheard us, he certainly did not acknowledge it. The tests were based on mathematics, of course, the universal language. We took our turns in the spotlight. Me, Chief, Wilmot, Frost, and me again, and damned if we did not pull it off. From what I understood, if one of us had flunked one of the tests, then that would have been game over. Anyway, it was basic stuff that the FBI's HR department throws at you, which makes sense, for the HR department is the closest thing to cosmic evil that I can think of. The Black Pharaoh did not even stay around for the awards ceremony. Then, suddenly, we were on top of the mountain. When I say we, I mean, of course, the seven of us. And, in another flashback from a year ago, one guy in full samurai armor, complete with face mask, flanked by eight pajama-wearing freaks, and glimpses of more freaks atop the ruins surrounding the plaza where we had arrived. On a positive note, there was also the stylus that we had been set out to find. Same thing as always. Little piggy, let us in. No. Surrender to us, or we'll huff and we'll puff and we'll blow your house down. Yeah, how about you blow us? Kill them. You know, standard rules of engagement. Then a sudden surprise, and a bit of a twist, as a familiar voice rings out from above. It was Desik, Desik the Black. That was mixed news, because the last time I saw him, he'd just taken a dive off the Red Ship to go out and seek Firth, who had just killed one of her brothers in arms. Not really coming together there, were we? And it inflicted a trauma on another that would lead to said other croaking as a result of being hit in the head by a monkey with a coconut. I could only hope that Desik had neutralized the archers that I suspected were posted on the higher ground. Then the pajama freaks and the samurai charged. He knew us. He knew what had happened in Louisiana to the Redneck Brigade. If he cared, he didn't show it. The initial charge was cut short by a wall of fire springing up out of nowhere. There were only two sorcerers that I knew and that were on our side, and I suspected we might be capable of such a feat, Firth and Isabeau. The wall of fire started spitting sparks, but most of the pajama platoon managed to dodge them, while their leader leapt over the wall, landing in our midst and fucking up my plan of forming a ring of steel around Tabitha and Devereaux. He was going after Tabitha. Wilmot moved to protect her, while the rest of us had to contend with the 90s-wearing idiots. Fire was raining down on the samurai from all sides, but he seemed to just shrug it off. Wilmot gave a good account of himself, and landed a couple of blows that would have sliced the samurai's arm off. His sword just seemed to pass through. But instead of the samurai losing his arm, one of his flunkies lost his. Not the best result, and very worrying, but better than nothing. Frost and Wilmot fought hard, and Chief did what he did best. He used his bulk to his advantage, shielding Tabitha, while Devereaux, Frost, and our unknown allies were wearing down the opposition. In the end, four of them went down, and the remaining four, most of them pretty grievously wounded, fled the scene. Then we all turned on the leader. That one jumped into the air as we were converging on him, and vanished. Devereaux started making a rub with the spell she needed, while the rest of us kept an eye out for stragglers. I kept everyone together, strength in numbers. It would have been nice to have captured one of them for questioning, but we had other priorities. Desik joined us, with two others in tow. Firth was one, acting a deal more sane than the last time I'd saw her. I did avoid bringing up the deaths of Rodon and Kalk. Not unlike rats, there are certain things that even I will not do. The other was fully wrapped up in thick clothing to shield her from daylight. I surmised that this was Isabeau. Events had taken their toll, but she seemed hesitant and a bit shaky on her feet. As Devereaux was completing her work, Desik confirmed what I had suspected. The Iron Army had flown one of their airships to the top of Mount Nagranek, and it was now vacant. Or so we hoped. We tried to involve Isabeau in her discussions as to our next actions, but her contribution was short and to the point. I need to feed. We all took that as our cue to cut and run, boarding the airship in no time at all. Chief seemed to have a rudimentary idea of how to fly the thing. I didn't really care where we went, as long as it was off the mountain, and out of the grasp of a hungry and probably undiscriminating Isabeau. After we were airborne, we made a sweep of the gondola, just in case the Iron Army was still hanging around. Nothing to be found, though. We had the choice. Head north now with a spell, as well as with this new toy, or return to the Red Ship and proceed from there. The Iron Army leader had been making ominous statements about the Red Ship, so I guess it's helped the Allies' time. Unless 13's finest have better ideas, of course.